Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, what we're trying to do here is reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. We are seeking to be equipped together to enter into the conversations of the day full of grace and truth, where you and I can, as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, actually not only have conversations that are genuinely diplomatic and genuinely dignified and accurate and truthful, but also graceful. So I want to lead off with a couple of headlines today. Wow. I mean, I think this is true every single day, but this weekend seemed to have provided a lot of headline news that is frankly, if you just stop and think about it for even just a moment, really easy to use as an entry point of conversation as a Christian into the conversations of the day. So this would be the headline that I would attach to this particular article, and it's the news out of the Seattle-Tacoma area about Richard Russell, where his family members are obviously what they describe as stunned and heartbroken after the airline worker stole a passenger plane on Friday from SeaTac, the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, and he was killed when he crashed 25 miles away almost an hour later. So when I listened to the statement that was issued by the family, I was really struck by one phrase, and it's a phrase that leaps out in the print editions of the coverage as well. And this is it: Jesus is truly the only one holding this family together. In the context of the family's statement, here's where that phrase appears. This is a complete shock to all of us, the family said in a statement they released Saturday night. We are devastated by these events. And Jesus is truly the only one holding this family together right now. As I heard that, I recognize the gravity of the statement. I also recognize the reality of the statement. I also recognize how that sounds to non-believing people. And I wondered how families who do not have Jesus as their solid rock, people who do not have Jesus as their point of integration, people who do not have Jesus as their chief cornerstone or the Lord of all, how do they hold it all together in such circumstances? The Apostle Paul describes Jesus as scientists who happen to be Christians have described as the very laminin of life. Laminin is apparently this like protein level thing going on in our bodies that, when you look at it in its DNA structure, it actually looks like a cross, and it is that which holds everything together. And so, when we describe Jesus as the laminin of life, we're borrowing from Colossians 1:17, where the Apostle Paul is speaking of the preeminence and supremacy of Jesus, and he says that Jesus is before all things, and in him all things hold together. I want you to think about that for a moment. How in your life is it Jesus who holds all things together? How does Jesus hold you together when you or your family or your job or your dreams or your health or your fill in the blank are falling apart? For me, this is a conversation about the faithful assurance of God's sovereignty and God's goodness, God's providence, God's faithfulness, God's eternal plan to make everything new, to fix everything that's broken, to actually bring not only redemption, but full restoration. I mean, for me, the conversation about how Jesus holds me together when everything in my life is falling apart or any part of my life is falling apart. For me, that is the substance of reality. I don't know how other people are holding it together without Jesus. And so there are many forces at work today trying to tear people up and tear families apart. And so I want us to lay claim today and then work on behalf of the one who really alone holds all things together. And certainly in the midst of this, we want to be praying for Richard Russell's family as the Lord upholds them and holds them together, even in the midst of this terrible personal family situation that they're facing. And I want to make a transition to people in California who are actively trying to hold it all together in the midst of a very active fire season. So we're going to actually talk in a few minutes with Pastor Jim Howe. Jim is a pastor in Redding, California. We reached out to him last week in the midst of the car fire, and car fire, C-A-R-R. And he said, hey, can I talk to you next week when, you know, things are frankly, you know, he was hoping that at this point, maybe things in the car fire would not be quite as hot as they were last week. And that is true. And so we're going to touch base with him in just a few minutes. But in the midst of that, the so-called holy fire in California has really ramped up. So an article about the holy fire that I pulled up this morning says this: on day six, so this would now be day seven, of the battle against the destructive holy fire, crews gained ground, increasing containment to 41%. Now, as a Christian who continues to pray for firefighters battling the so-called holy fire in California, I got to say, this is a situation when the news is providing a pretty easy leverage point for conversation for you and I with people in our community. So when you think of holy fire, I want to know what comes to mind. For you and I as Christians, what may come to mind when we hear the phrase holy fire is the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. But a lot of people don't know anything about that. What comes to mind for you may be the Spirit's refining work in the life of the believer. What comes to mind for many people is what they've heard about a fiery hell and the wrath of God. So in the church, we sing songs like, you know, send your fire. But we have to remember that we've got an unbelieving world that is hearing that language very differently than the way we're singing it. Yes, fire has a purging effect, and it's rightly fear-producing. But I think that means that we as believers, we got to handle the use of such a word and its power with great care. And so, you know, maybe we want to set aside the singing of send your fire during this season in much the same way that we set aside the your love is like a hurricane language after a particularly devastating hurricane season the last couple of years. What do our unbelieving neighbors think when they hear the word holy attached to the word fire? What do we mean by the word holy? I mean, we certainly recognize that God is holy and God defines holiness. But what does that mean? Is God's holiness demonstrated in creation and redemption or just wrath? So while holiness includes God's absolute moral perfection and therefore reveals sin as that which is contrary to holiness, I want us to think about whether or not God's holiness existed prior to and apart from sin. And if so, what does that mean? If God is eternally holy, even before we are fallen, then God's holiness includes something other than wrath. God is holy before and apart from the reality of sin. So God's holiness must encompass not only moral perfection and goodness, but beauty in all of its truthfulness. Now, who among us fears beauty? So God's holiness might be a cause for fear for those who reject God's ways, but God's holiness is also like a flame to which we like moths are drawn, longing to be near him, longing to know him more and more, longing to gaze upon the beauty of his face. Now back to our prayers for those suffering in the holy fire and the car fire, more than a dozen other fires raging in California alone. Let us pray prayers like, holy God, send refreshing rains, dampen the wind, encourage and protect those on the front lines. Use this in ways we cannot currently imagine to reveal your glory through restoration and new life, and even the preservation of things precious to people. It's in that spirit that we are going to enter into a conversation with Jim Howe. So Jim is a pastor in Redding, California. He actually pastors the First Presbyterian Church of Redding, California. It is a church affiliated with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, the EPC. I know that that denomination and his local church have set up recovery funds for local recovery there. It's an emergency fund. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about efforts between more than 50 pastors in the region to be sure that people's needs are met, but that there's not a duplication of efforts. We're going to talk about who else is on the ground there, the kinds of things that people need, and how those needs are going to be met. So we're going to have an update from the literal middle of the fiery furnace in America's most populated state. Next up, Pastor Jim Howe of Redding, California. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me now is Pastor Jim Howe. Pastor Howe serves in Redding, California at the First Presbyterian Church there. He's here today to give us an update on the Carr Fire, C-A-R-R, that we have been following and praying in relationship to as we've been praying the news the last couple of weeks. Jim, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on the air today.
So we have we've been sharing with folks that your denomination, the EPC, has an emergency fund set up in Redding to aid in local recovery, and we want to talk with you about that. But let's start by just kind of sharing with people where you are and what you've been experiencing.
Well, it's been a very, very difficult time, as you can imagine. More than half of our congregation was evacuated during the fire. Our church, First Press, is located on the hill on the west side of Redding where the fire came. And that Thursday night of the fire, when it began on a Monday, and by Thursday night, it was threatening the city, clear down to downtown. And people were evacuated. Lines were long. My own brother was evacuated and came and stayed with us. We honestly didn't even know if the church would still be there when everything was over. It didn't get anywhere that close. It really was a miraculous and heroic effort that Cal Fire and all the other firefighters put out. Redding Fire Department, DC-10s were coming in and bombing the fire with fire retardant, with massive payloads of fire retardant, and there were a number of homes that were burned. There were fire tornadoes, as you've probably heard. One of our members had a next-door neighbor's roof lifted off their home and put in their backyard, and Mary Jean, who's served on the session here at First Press in the past, she said to her neighbors, you can have your roof back now. So there's been humor in the midst of deep, deep pain and sorrow. And then people began to return home that following Monday and Tuesday. There are still portions affected by the fire where people are still evacuated. It's more on the furthest west end. The fire has grown some to the north and the south. It's now 65% contained. The smoke has been overwhelming. The air has been very unhealthy. So the ongoing realities of the fire are very real. We have two new fires in the local vicinity. One is just on another arm of Lake Shasta. And it's over 3,000 acres already, and it's only 2% contained. And then there's another fire on the other end of 299. And last I heard, it was over 20% contained and about 3,000 acres.
Okay, so can we pause there, and can I ask what from, you know, the very wet southeastern United States is going to sound like a question that everyone should know the answer to, but context really matters. When you talk about a fire being 2% contained or 20% contained or 40% contained or 65% contained, I'm thinking to myself, a fire that's 1% uncontained is scary. So can you kind of help us understand what that language means?
Well, it has to do with the fire line. How much of, if you were to look on a map at the Carr Fire, you would see the acreage that's been burned. And if you were to draw a circle, if it were a perfect circle, if you were to draw a line around it, when we say 65% contained, that means 65% of the fire line is under control of the firefighters.
So the bigger the fire, the more difficult that is, because you're talking about at the physical geography. Like, it gets bigger, and therefore the line around it gets bigger. Well, that actually, I think, helps people make sense of it. And then there might be one direction in which where they're not particularly worried about the fire burning itself out, and so 65% containment might mean the entire side that we're really concerned about, because it's the side of the quote-unquote circle that is threatening communities.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct. The most important thing was controlling the eastern side of the fire, because it started in a national park at Whiskeytown. A car had a flat tire. A spark from the metal hitting the pavement ignited the grass, and we actually had pretty good rain this spring, but rains and our golden California hills, that means tall grass, and when grass is busted, everything just goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So it spread very quickly.
So I would love for you to share the story of the Providence Ministry, because I know just enough about it to be intrigued. So we have homeless people who are raising fruits and vegetables, and they are now serving newly homeless people, or people made homeless by the fire. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Reading in the past 10 years, with the change in our criminal justice system and a lot of prisoners being released to the streets for less violent crimes, they're given a bus ticket and sent to Reading. So we have approximately 600 homeless people in Reading. Some of them are drug affected. Some of them are mentally ill. Bud Hancock, properly known as Robert, he actually worked with the Reagan administration way back in the day. He moved to Reading well over a decade ago, and he had already begun Providence International. They do microloans internationally because of his concern about how grants were used internationally to other countries. He felt it was better to help people individually. So when he came to Reading and saw the need there, the dream was before him that somehow that they'd be able to work with homeless people, re-educate them in the job force, give them a resume and a reference so that they'd be able to re-enter the job force. So they raise vegetables. They've reclaimed some areas around Reading that previously were not being used along the riverfront, right along I-5, planted orchards. It's been a big task, and Bud Hancock is a man with a big vision, and there are a number of people that were formerly homeless that are working for Providence. They raise produce, and the goal is to provide 30 pounds of produce per family that was affected by the fire that over the next 10 weeks, just to get them started.
I just love that story. I mean, I think it is one of those stories of not just neighbors helping neighbors, but, you know, sometimes, Jim, those of us who do not perceive ourselves as the Christ in need, but the Christ in a position to help others, we forget that there are times that because of things like a fire, because of things that we can't guard against, really, we cannot adequately guard against, that we might find ourselves on the receiving end or the needing end of those who otherwise we thought we were in a position to help. And I think this is a beautiful story of the gospel all the way around.
Right, right. Yes, it's, and even one of the other positive factors in all of this is that I mentioned to a friend of mine, he's a pastor of a Calvary Chapel here in Reading, Brian Blank. He's at Little Country Church, which is not little, it's a mega church. at our meeting last week, I approached him and I said, well, it's sad to say that it took a fire to bring us together, but at least we're together. Hmm. And we're praying together and looking at the needs of the community together. And that's very, very crucial, because the issues that Reading faces, you know, with this homeless problem, one of the issues with the fire was the looting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is related to the same population. That's why one of the reasons why the National Guard had to come in is because they were afraid, and it did happen. Some people evacuated their homes, and while their homes were evacuated, they were looted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that we don't, so that you and I don't run out of time before we tell people how they can help you as you are helping others. Give folks the best place online to help you help your neighbors.
Okay, the primary source of giving right now is through the Evangelical Presbyterian Church website, epc.org, and you go to disaster relief, and you go to the section that has been set up for the car fire. That money will go into a fund. Jeff Jeremiah, our stated clerk, has let me know that money will come to First Press, and we'll be responsible for sending that money out to families. And what we're doing is we're taking a relational approach, yeah, and we'll be identifying one family at a time.
Jim, you and I are going to have to you and I are going to have to leave it right there, because we have to go to a hard break. Friends, it's epc.org. Go to disaster relief for the car fire. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
All right, Carmen.
Hey friends, welcome back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Privileged to be joined today by Irish barrister Lorcan Price. Lorcan, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you very much.
So Lorcan was engaged with the Irish referendum representing the pro-life efforts in Ireland. And we have talked about the referendum here on Connecting Faith. We talked about the outcome, but I would love, Lorcan, for you to walk us back through that. This is a constitutional referendum to, you know, change the constitution of a country in relationship to the life issue. Tell me in the lead up to that, sort of what that felt like in terms of, I live in a country that might actually be changing its mind on something so substantial.
Well, there was a lot at stake. In 1983, the Irish people decided to put the guarantee of the right to life for the unborn child into the constitution, largely because concerns arose that we could see a Roe v. Wade type scenario in my country. And what the campaign that I was involved in did then was it came forward with a set of words that essentially sought to guarantee both the right to life of the unborn child and of the mother, and ensured in that sense then that the right to life of the unborn child could not be taken unless there was a threat to the life of the mother. And that was interpreted strictly. What happened in Ireland then was between 1983 and this year, we've seen enormous cultural change in the same way, really, that you probably see in the rest of the Western world. There's been a decline in the extent to which people are religiously observant, and there has been an increase in the extent to which people are eager to see abortion introduced to the country. So our approach to this was to try and make quite clear to people that Ireland, with the right to life of the unborn child guaranteed, was still an incredibly safe country for women in healthcare, and we have the United Nations figures to support us on that, and that it was also a country that respected life at all its stages. We wanted to make it clear that you can protect the right to life of both the mother and the unborn child, and indeed the umbrella campaign during the referendum was called Love Both. That meant love the mother and love the unborn child, and both of those, that they're not incompatible, those things. You can do both of them, and you can do them both from a healthcare perspective and a legal perspective. Sadly, however, what we faced over the last two decades really has been an onslaught of pressure on the country from the United Nations and its various bodies, from celebrities, from political elites that seek to have abortion introduced. What we discovered in 2017 was that the Open Societies Foundation, funded by George Soros, had been pumping money into the country on the pro-abortion side. Amnesty International, with its Irish branch, has campaigned heavily for abortion. And gradually, you've seen the political landscape change. As I was saying to you before we came on air, one of the things that makes this country pretty much unique in the Western world is the extent to which you have a diverse media. You have different voices in the public square. We don't have that in my country and in a lot of Europe. We have one voice, and it's a liberal voice, and it's a pro-abortion voice. So when you look at what was stacked on the side advocating for abortion, they were pretty formidable odds. I can't go further without mentioning, though, the problems in the Catholic Church as well. And these are not inconsequential. Ireland has seen, really since the early 90s, revelations about abuse committed by a small number of priests, but covered up, sadly, by the church. And this has emerged in other countries, in Australia and in the United Kingdom and so on. But in Ireland, the difference was the church had enormous cultural influence, it had enormous political power. The country was 90% Catholic in the early 90s. That has since declined, obviously. But the shock that the abuse scandals delivered to the moral authority of the church was enormous. So you have a situation where the main institution that's not connected to the government or the media, the church, has now been sidelined as a result of the abuse scandals. And then you have all the other factors that I mentioned. So that all led us to 2018. And while we didn't anticipate winning, we were hopeful, obviously, and we thought it was narrow, the defeat was quite substantial in the end. It was over 60% in favour of abortion. And that leaves, for those of us, I'm 32, for those of us who've been involved in the pro-life campaign much longer than I have, I got involved in university, it was really devastating to see, friends and neighbours and even in some cases family members vote to take out the right to life. At least in other countries, it was a judicial elite or a political elite that did that. And you could say, well, they don't have the support of the people. It's a very different scenario when the people themselves choose to do that. And I can only really say that, they were exposed to enormous amounts of propaganda, and there was very little space for us in that landscape, both political and media, to get our message in. Now, we tried to use new media a lot, Google, Facebook, and social media. But even in the closing stages of the campaign, the Irish government put a lot of pressure on Google and Facebook. And Google pulled all advertising to do with the referendum, which hit us harder than it hit the other side because they had the legacy media on board. And Facebook banned what they called all foreign advertising to do with the referendum. And when you consider those kind of odds against small organizations like ourselves and the pro-life campaign, it's a wonder that we even got the vote we did. But when we've looked at the polling analysis since the vote, and we've tried to break it down by why people voted the way they did. And most Irish people who voted in favour of removing the right to life thought that they were only introducing a certain amount of abortion, that it would be a kind of a low level, so only in extreme cases where there was a sexual crime, like rape, for example, or where the child had a very severe disability and was likely to be born only to live a few hours or days. What we were trying to explain to people was what the government had in store was a lot wider than that, a lot more radical. Now, we never really had the space to get that message out. And I've since realised that people have been approaching me because they know I was involved in the campaign from television and radio appearances. They've been approaching me and saying, oh, I'm sorry I voted yes now because I didn't realise it would be this wide. And, you know, that's been very disappointing to hear. So it's not the case that the country has totally turned against the right to life, but they were manipulated into thinking that they were doing something very narrow when in fact what the government had in store was much wider.
Friends, you are listening to the voice of Lorcan Price. Lorcan is an Irish barrister, worked very actively to represent the pro-life campaign in Ireland, which you can actually find at prolifecampaign.ie. Lorcan, following the vote on the referendum, one of the things that we talked about here in America was the, announcement, declaration by the Irish Prime Minister that Catholic hospitals, Roman Catholic hospitals, would be required then to perform abortions, that there would be no exemptions for institutions. Tell us about that conversation in Ireland, and then, you know, that seems like an egregious. It's not just a threat. I mean, it's an egregious violation of religious freedom.
Oh, I completely agree. That's exactly what it is. This is part of a broader problem in Europe, where the right to conscientiously object to taking life is always regarded as being less or even irrelevant compared to the so-called right to an abortion. So from Sweden, where midwives are being forced to perform abortions, to France, where doctors and pharmacists are being obliged to provide contraceptives and so on, there's very little regard, I'd say scant regard in Europe to the notion of the right of conscience. And we see something similar in Ireland, where the Prime Minister, without fear of any pushback from, in the public square, from the media and so on, is able to essentially make a demand like that. And the government defend it this way. They say, well, most of healthcare in the Republic of Ireland is controlled or is provided by hospitals that have a Catholic ethos. And that is correct as a statement of fact. And their view would be, well, if we allow the Catholics to have an exemption here, nobody's going to get any abortions at all. So we have to force them into this, these hospitals, in order to be able to provide the abortions that, you know, we want to push through. That's their agenda. However, though, they run up against provisions in the Irish Constitution that guarantee a right to religious freedom for individuals, but also for institutions. This has never been litigated in the past, so we don't have any case law on what these protections mean in Article 44 of the Irish Constitution. They have to mean something, obviously, and the words have meaning. What we have to try and do now, as lawyers who are looking at this question, is apply the guarantees in the Constitution to the reality of a hospital founded by the Catholic Church with a Catholic ethos. That's now being told by a government, you know, you must, as a matter of law, provide abortions. And this will end up in court because it's our view that to require people institutionally and individually to do something so utterly opposed to their own deeply held beliefs is the mark of a government that has really no regard whatsoever for religious liberty or religious rights.
Friends, I'm talking with Lorcan Price. He's an Irish barrister, and one of the concerns that he works on are issues related to life. So we've been centering our conversation, Lorcan, on the on the conversation at one end of life. I'm wondering if in Ireland, as in other places, there are conversations taking place about the right to die or the liberty to have physician-assisted suicide, because it seems as if the dignity of life conversation, if you are willing to violate it on one end, you probably have a growing willingness to violate it on the other end.
Yes, the conversation is certainly there, particularly on the far left. In the Irish Parliament, a private member's bill, as we call it, so a piece of legislation proposed by an individual member of the Parliament, sought to introduce so-called legislation to deal with dying with dignity, as he put it, physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. And I'll use the terms together, even though there are differences. But you're completely correct. Where you no longer believe that, or where the belief has gone that life is sacred, that it's sacred because it's God-given, and that protecting life is what a civilized society should do, that means then, as a matter of convenience, either at the early stages of life or the later stages of life, it can be taken away. And it's not just a question of people who are terminally ill and so on. The sad reality in Europe is that in places like Belgium and the Netherlands, younger people who are not suffering from a terminal illness are being killed or euthanized. I was just reading recently of a case in the Netherlands where a 29-year-old lady with depression was euthanized. She went to visit the crematorium where she would be, her remains would be disposed of, before she went to the euthanasia clinic. So this was described before as a culture of death. And I think where people like this young lady had a party to celebrate the fact that she was going to kill herself, with the assistance and the active participation of others, with the with that being permitted by the state or facilitated by the state, is a really frightening reflection on the kind of society we have on the other side of the Atlantic. And I know there are calls in my own country to do this. After the referendum result, I would suggest that the government now, and it's a government on the left, or it's supported by left-wing independent members of parliament, would feel no real restraint on it from going further and further with ever more radical proposals. And this is what happens, I suppose, when the floodgates open, out comes rushing all kinds of really dark and socially destructive policy.
Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. We've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Irish barrister Lorcan Price. We're going to lighten things up. I'm going to ask him why he wears a wig. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. To Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Welcome back. Continuing my conversation with Irish barrister Lorcan Price. So I will admit to you that I know little about barristers. So tell our listening audience what a barrister is, what a barrister does, and what a barrister wears on their head and why.
Well, in this
it's
country,
radio, so he's not wearing one.
I'm not
right
wearing
now.
One now. No, no. I have one upstairs in my suitcase. But in this country, you have a very sensible system when it comes to the law. You have attorneys. They both meet the clients in their offices. They discuss with them whether or not they have a case or whatever the dispute is, whether it can be solved without going to court or if you must go to court, and then they go to court with their client. On the other side of the pond, in the UK and Ireland and the British Isles, you must first meet a solicitor. And a solicitor will...
Here, a solicitor is not
a very different thing. Yeah, that's true. My wife is a solicitor. I told her not to tell too many people that because it would be misunderstood, to say the least. But on the other side of the Atlantic, in the British Isles, as I say, you must first meet the solicitor. The solicitor will discuss with you whatever your problem is and whether or not it requires a solution in court, so if it becomes litigious. And at that point, then, a barrister gets involved. We're totally independent of solicitors, and we are based in England, at least in chambers, and in Ireland, down at the courts in what's called the Law Library. It's a very ancient system where the idea was that somebody would go in and plead your case, and you'd have this group of barristers hanging around the courts ready to represent clients. We still dress, my court garb looks something like a kind of a 18th century preacher. I wear a long gown. I wear a little, kind of a little white.
Genevan tabs.
Genevan tabs, exactly. Tabs. And I wear a horsehair wig.
Like seriously made of horsehair?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Do you know the horse?
I don't know, but I hope he died a peaceful death. I could tell him that I'm putting his hair to good use now. It's keeping my head warm in the cold Irish courts. Of course, the problem with wearing all this gear is that during the summer months, it gets very, very warm underneath it. But during the winter months, even in the Irish courts, it still doesn't really keep you that warm. So that's why you'll often see lawyers at least generating enough hot air to keep themselves warm as well as everyone else in the court. But it's a very old garb. It's really it's gone out of fashion in some of the lower courts in Ireland. It was obligatory to wear your wig until up to a number of years ago. It's no longer obligatory, so you still see some older barristers wearing it, but the young guys have all dropped the wig.
But you're a young guy.
Yeah, I'm kind of a traditionalist, I suppose. What I've taken to doing now, depending on the judge, if the judge is wearing a wig, I'll wear the wig. If the judge isn't wearing a wig, I'll just kind of carry it under my arm. So it comes around with me as emergencies. I can leave it on the desk and put my pens in it until I have to put it on.
Friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, joined today by Irish barrister Lorcan Price. We're talking about the Irish referendum related to life. We're talking about Irish life in general. I would love for you, Lorcan, to just to share with people, as a person of faith, what's your experience in Ireland or in Europe generally? Like, here in America, our experience of the diversity of faith is growing. Our conversations about faith are robust. Even in our secular media, there are lots of God-oriented conversations. Scripture is often brought to bear. I'm just kind of, give us a... you've experienced things here in the U.S. Give us some comparisons. Excuse me.
Sure. What strikes me listening to public officials in the U.S. here, including your Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is their willingness and the extent to which they will cite scripture, mention their own faith. God bless America is the phrase that jumps to mind. That is, I would say, without fear of contradiction, almost entirely absent in public life on the other side of the Atlantic, not just in my own country, where I cannot remember the last time that I heard an Irish government minister talk about God. Right across Europe, I practice a lot in Strasbourg, in France, at the European Court of Human Rights. And, of course, the French have a tradition of not talking about religion in public. You will never hear a government official reference their faith. You'll never hear an elected politician talk about that. And the difference, it's hard to really understate this. When one's here in the in the United States, on both sides of the political divide, as you say, and in the secular media, there are references made to religion and God. On the other side of the Atlantic, the only conversation about religion is the threat posed by aggressive Islam. Christianity is almost entirely absent from the political square. And I'd be if anyone disputes that with me, who might be listening in Europe, I'd be delighted to talk to them about it, because that's been my experience both in the European Parliament, which I've spoken at events there, in my own Parliament in Dublin in Ireland, and in the other international institutions, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe and so on. So the difference is enormous. Europe is secularized, and this is a cause for increasing concern, because into the vacuum is stepping Islam. And there are people who've written very well on this. Douglas Murray is an author I would recommend, who looks at the problem that a Europe that has essentially given up on the religious beliefs that have been hard won, the freedoms down through the centuries, and in the last, I would say, kind of 50 years, that has gone. I mean, when you think about Winston Churchill, would make references to scripture in speeches. The idea that Theresa May, the current prime minister, would do that is I think a fanciful one. You'll hear a lot of talk about European values and British values, but nobody defines those. And those that make some attempt to define them never refer to the Christian heritage that has really given Europe the political cohesion and the rights that we enjoy today. So to use a southern phrase, the baby has been thrown out with the bathwater. In an attempt to be progressive and secular, they have erased entirely that Christian history, references to God. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but when the European Union was attempting to put together a constitution, the then Pope, Pope John Paul II, raised the question of whether or not there would be a reference to the Christian heritage of Europe and God in the constitution. And that was viciously opposed across Europe, particularly by the socialists who were in power in a number of European countries. So there's a very entrenched opposition to public discussion of faith. And I know this from personal experience. I've spoken publicly about my faith as a young Catholic in Ireland. And I have received, to put it politely, you know, unpleasant feedback from people. And the view commonly held is that if we can get rid of religion out of the public discussion, it will make for a better society. But that doesn't apply, of course, when it comes to Islam. A lot of European politicians will be tripping over themselves to welcome Islam as a religion of peace and so on. So things are very confused on the other side of the Atlantic.
Friends, my conversation partner today has been Irish barrister Lorcan Price. Lorcan, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you for having me, Carmen. It's been a pleasure.
Friends, you can get more information at prolifecampaign.ie, and we will be watching the press throughout Europe for Lorcan's influential representation of concerns related to religious liberty and life. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be... Hey, friends, we actually aren't quite out of time, but I hope you enjoyed that conversation that I actually recorded last week with Irish barrister Lorcan Price. Sometimes I have occasion to put a little audio down that I can then share with you. And if you, if that's of interest to you, sort of what's happening with Christians around the world, I'd love your feedback and input on that. So you can communicate with me via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. I'd appreciate that. Again, that's carmen@myfaithradio.com. I've got a must-read Monday posted today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And as always, you can go to My Faith Radio and share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.